small job these days to keep alive a grassroots radio station, so I want to thank everybody here for continuing to do the work that you do, and particularly people like Marianne, who are station managers, program directors. This is tough work, and we need you like crazy. So thanks for doing what you do. Well, what to say? I haven't been at a grassroots radio conference in a long time, but whenever I'm here, I'm reminded that you really are our ears to the ground. You're hearing what's happening and you're telling what's happening. And those of us who, as Marianne has said, have kind of tried to build more media institutions, I talked about a little bit in the workshop, we keep coming back to grassroots radio because you are a model of a sustainable scale that makes a real impact where you work. And that's something that you really need to take a moment to feel excited and glad about. So thank you, and thank everybody who came up for bringing us all together. What's the day today? May 14th, right? 15th. 14th, I was right the first time, thank you. The 14th of May, anniversary of what? Who knows? Come on. Something. Anniversary of something. Having... Louder? Jackson State. What happened to Jackson State? Two dead, right? Move anniversary. Jackson State 10 days after Kent State. Where did you hear the news today about Jackson State, remembering Jackson State? Democracy Now. So score one for grassroots radio. Listening to the discussion about Jackson State this morning on the radio as I was driving up here, I was thinking, you know, we remember the killings, right? Kent State, Jackson State, abuse of police power. We forget why people were on the campuses, right? They were on the campuses protesting the war. Jackson State, they said it wasn't about what happened at Kent State, although that was part of it. It was routine that students were on the out on the campus protesting like that. Routine. And the two that were killed, one wasn't even a student. But the bullets that went into that women's dorm, the girls' dorm, female students' dorm, were very effective in both threatening freedom of speech on the campus and intimidating people, not permanently, but for a while there. We forget what it was like back then. I mean, I wasn't here, but many of us in the room, many of us here in this group remember that moment, remember that the roiling that was going on in those years. And you have to look at this moment that we're in right now. We have 983 U.S. service people dead in Afghanistan, getting on for 1,000, who knows how many civilian deaths, getting on for 4,500 U.S. service people dead in Iraq. You've got the president yesterday saying, or 2 days ago, saying that he is accountable for civilian deaths in Afghanistan. Did everybody hear that? He's meeting there with his newly refound friend, Hamid Karzai. I take full responsibility. I am accountable for all civilian deaths. And you want to say, well, how exactly are you accountable? Right. How could those people who've lost hundreds of thousands, probably millions at this point, hundreds of thousands of their loved ones in those two countries actually hold you accountable? Under international criminal law? I don't think so. The World Court? I don't think so. You've got the stories that come and go that remind you where we're at. In February, U.S. Special Forces shot and killed five. Remember that? Three women who were between them had something like 16 kids and a pregnant woman. Two pregnant women? The story was covered up, right? And remember what the people on the ground said. They said, well, actually, part of the cover-up involved what we think was special ops people cutting the bullets out of the bodies so that they could say it was a Taliban killing, not a U.S. Special Forces killing. Now, I don't mean to start with such a downer, but the response of this administration to that incident was to do, we're going to do an investigation, right? Unlike the bad old administration, we're going to do an investigation. They did an investigation, they found out there'd been an accident. Jeremy Crystal said it was accidental. And what about the digging out of the bullets part? The president this week said, wars are difficult, what was his language? War is tough, and mistakes happen. This, as the spending on the Afghanistan war is just now, as we speak, exceeding the spending on the Iraq war. I mean, for the last time I was traveling around this country with the book was the Blue Grip book, which was about an upsurge in grassroots activism in between 2000 and 2006. And it was making the case that there was more progressive politics in this country than anything is reflected in the Democratic Party. And there were more explanations for why Democrats got defeated than was simply reflected in casting aspersions on grassroots progressives. But it was how Democrats were running for office. It was the kind of positions they were or weren't taking. It wasn't the lack of progressive opinion in this country. Well, now, I mean, you heard my enthusiasm earlier today. I'm optimistic about many things. But I'm discouraged by what happened to that mobilization of people who did one thing. They got a new president elected, right? Yes, we can. Si se puede. Change we can believe in. And si se puede, yes, elect a president. But si se puede keep that president accountable, we're not doing any better job than the civilians of Afghanistan. I mean, look at this moment. I'll be a little bit more of a downer for just a little bit longer. Look at this moment. You've got oil belching in the Gulf, right? And now it could be 5,000 barrels a day that BP says it is, or it could be 70,000 barrels a day. We're just not quite sure. And there's a great progress that anybody is questioning BP at all because for the first 10 days of that BP disaster, the Coast Guard was operating from BP headquarters and more or less just repeating what BP was saying. We interviewed environmental groups from the Gulf Coast who might know when I went down to cover the breaking of the levees, and they said we wanted to send independent airplanes over the Deepwater Horizon to see what was happening after the explosion. Because remember what happened? There were 11 people killed in that explosion. Have we forgotten that part? The explosion, the oil was said to be under control for 10 days. Well, these local environmental groups said they've got the money together. Some of these environmental groups in this country really do have some resources. And they said they had a plane. They were going to send a plane over. They were denied access to the airspace. I said, by whom? By British Petroleum. Now, I'm not exactly sure what being denied access to airspace means. What are they going to do? Come and shoot you out of the air? I'm not sure. But when they tried to get a permit to fly over, maybe their mistake was asking for a permit. Barack Obama today, what did he say? You've all been busy in workshops. But he said he was disgusted by the finger pointing that happened this week in the Senate, where you had the guy from Halliburton and the guy from Transocean and the guy from BP. All there saying, he did it. You know, wasn't me, it was him. What did they call it on MSNBC? The Shuggy defense. Well, Barack Obama is doing his own version of finger pointing, even by suggesting that the problem is simply those three guys, or the problem is his agent, the structure of the agencies, and the fact that the agencies, the MMS, has been asleep on the job. Because his very own Interior Secretary, Ken Salazar, who you guys, particularly you in Colorado, have been reporting on for years, was he exactly the kind of si se puede change we can believe in appointee to the Interior Secretary that you had in mind to replace Gail Norton? Not exactly. I mean, this is a guy who received money himself from British Petroleum, and then his two biggest donors were from the law firms representing coal. Barack Obama's election campaign, I think, as brilliantly reported in Counterpunch, thank you, Alexander, received $70,000 from the oil industry. More than twice the closest competitor. I mean, I think what we've seen in the last 2 years of this administration is a veneer of new backed up with the same old story. And I don't blame the president. That's what presidents do. I blame us. We mobilized many of us around that campaign, many hundreds of thousands of people mobilized for change. And they came into my studio after the election and said, we're going to stay on him. We're going to keep on him. I can't tell you how many people told me that story about FDR and who exactly did he say it to, but how many times have we heard it? I agree with you, now make me do it. There's a big debate about who it was exactly that he was speaking to. I've got my, whatever, we'll get into it. But everybody came into the studio and said, we're going to make him do it, we're going to blah, blah. I just don't see it. This very week, you have a climate bill presented in the Senate, Carrie Lieberman, lovely duo, presenting a bill that continues offshore drilling, that continues the ongoing relationship with fossil fuels, that continues basically the coal lobby's power in Washington, and actually does a good amount to roll back the power of the EPA and roll back the power of states to prosecute under the Clean Air Act and other laws. You have the president saying, we're not going to accept this cozy relationship anymore between the Interior Secretary, the Department of the Interior, and the oil companies. But his very own Secretary of the Interior was approving oil drilling permits yesterday with a waiver on the environmental regulations. 27 such offshore permits have been granted under a special waiver that the Salazar administration fought for last year since the Deepwater Horizon explosion. 29 miners were killed in Virginia, in West Virginia, in that Massey Energy mine. If you can't, with the votes of all those environmentalists behind you, come out in a week or a month that has seen 29 miners dead, in a company owned by a guy who said it's the cost of doing business, 11 people dead, rig workers dead in the Gulf, by a guy who yesterday, Tony Hayward, said, well, it's a very big body of water, the amount of oil that we're pouring into it is very small. It's a huge ocean. He said it's a vast ocean and a tiny poop, tiny spill in comparison, right? He told that to the British Guardian or the Independent or something yesterday. It's a vast ocean. If you can't, in a week like this, say enough with the votes that you have, with the control that you have, what are we waiting for? And frankly, what are the trade unions waiting for? What are the environmental groups waiting for? The NRDC endorsed the climate bill with its vastly reduced expectations for emissions reductions, reduced over anything that the experts say is important? If not now, when, is sort of my question for this moment. And one last example of the finger pointing, the Goldman Sachs hearings were fun to watch, weren't they? Oh my God. Yeah, it's good TV viewing. Better if you just watched it on C-SPAN. Yeah. Claire McCaskill, really strong. Well, that's gambling, isn't it? Yeah, that's gambling. You mean to say you bet on the failure of the very same package you were selling to your clients? Shock horror. That's gambling. And Blank Fine, double L Lloyd, Blank Fine, sitting there saying, what kind of this is, you sort of felt sorry for him. So saying, well, this is kind of what we do on Wall Street. You know, I mean, he didn't actually say we call it capitalism, but he could have said that. I began to feel sorry for the guy. You've got Carl Levin, who was part of the team that approved exactly giving him permission to do the kind of thing he's been doing, saying, how dare you? And there was sort of nobody in the commentary that said, wait a minute. Blankfein may not be doing God's work, his wonderful line to the Independent, but you guys played a role in setting things up this way. None of your fingers is clean here. And Barack Obama's Secretary of the Treasury is probably responsible more than any other single individual for helping to clear the regulations out of the way for exactly the kind of violations of morality, if not of law, that we're seeing. We're being told the economy is on a rebound. Right? Upswing? What's the word they use right now? It's making its way back? Reviving? It's hard for us to come up with the word because it's pretty hard to find the reality. But I don't know how many of you saw the front page of the business section of the New York Times a few weeks back. It was basically mugshots. Did anybody see that? The top hedge fund earners are back in the money again, earning on average between the top 25 a billion each last year, right? The year where we lost 8 million jobs. The top owner, or one of the third top owner, is Carl Icahn. Remember him from the 1980s? He was the big He was the big restructuring guy.
The flight attendant strike.
Right? And what else? He was the axe man. He was the one that would come in and lay people off work. Shrink workforce. Well, he's now one of the top three hedge fund owner. I think he owns something like $350 billion in the last year. No, $350 million in the last year. How did he do it? Well, he told the Financial Times debt was underrated, meaning undervalued. It was something he invested in. I thought, well, that's great. So in the 1980s, you spend your power laying people off, and in the 2000s, you get rich off how indebted they all are. What this means, it seems to me, when we talk about a recovery or whatever it is there is a section of our economy that is coming back. It's on Wall Street. You see it in your returns, your quarterly returns if you're an investor. You particularly see it if you're a hedge fund guy. And I think they just about are all guys. And what is that money really doing? Is it creating jobs? Is it underwriting schools? Building new things? No, it's betting on things like, will the tea bill go up 10 cents on Tuesday? It's betting, as many of these banks did, on the fate of the economy of Greece. Is it going to go up? Is it going to go down? There's a massive trade right now, derivatives gambling, on the economy of our states. Maybe you saw the story about how finally the Attorney General in California is going to investigate the role of the banks in both setting the bonds, the levels for the bonds of the state, and also betting against the state's ability to pay back its debts. They do both. In New York right now, where I'm from, we just had 2,000 transit workers laid off last week. Somewhere recently just auctioned its Capitol building. Phoenix. Yeah, well, it's Arizona, maybe we don't want them. But who bought it? Did they check the papers of the guy who bought it? I'm not sure. We did a story on Grit TV this week about after-school programs that affect 20,000 kids. For the lack of $20 million, they're going to cut those after-school programs all across the country. And there is a great revival on Wall Street in, among other things, betting on the ability of cities to pay their debts. So sure, you have an economy rising over here, but it's a rising on betting against the rest of us. And Barack Obama and those in the administration talk about how they're going to get, you know, there's going to be investigations into whether laws were broken. None of this is actually illegal. So we have a much bigger problem than the laws. One in five Americans right now is either unemployed or underemployed. One in nine can't pay their credit card bills. One in eight is having trouble with their mortgage, is going into foreclosure. 4 out of 10 African American young boys, meaning under 35, young men, are unemployed. And 44% of all of those who are unemployed today have been unemployed for more than 6 months. We lost 8 million jobs, $5 trillion in assets. And we're being told everything's okay? I mean, this is really, and I talked about this at lunchtime, where I think that grassroots radio comes in. Because for once, the story is not far away someplace else, someone else. It's us. It's right here in your neighborhoods. And this isn't, frankly, a story that we can do well from the national level. Well, we can, but we can only do it with your help. This is one of those narratives that you need to be telling. What is happening where you live? One of the answers I often get to, and let me tell you what's happening where you live, because you've been out of news. Arnold Schwarzenegger announced his budget today. $19 billion deficit for the state, right? He thinks he can get $12 billion how? eliminating the welfare program, eliminating CalWORKs. 1.4 million people, two-thirds of them children. Eliminating childcare. He'll keep the colleges going. He'll keep the parks funded. But we're talking about eliminating basic services for the most vulnerable of us. That's your story. It's right here. And it hasn't happened yet. He's just presenting the budget. And he's going clearly to where the least noise is. He's going to the poor, the female, the undocumented, the vulnerable, the voiceless. The students managed to kick up a bit of a ruckus. Certainly their professors did. The parks? We love the parks. But are you telling me the environmental movement is stronger than the economic justice movement in this country? And why is that? I'm not finding a lot of jokes in all of this, am I? I'm sorry about that. But I do sometimes have to laugh about the discourse that I am involved in. I feel it's my duty to make occasional appearances when they invite me in other media, the All About Money media, I call it. Because I remember when I worked at FAIR and I headed up the women's desk and we would be able to document the bias, but then I would call grassroots women's leaders and say, would you go on these shows? And they wouldn't do it. Give me a week and I'll prepare the op-ed. No, you have to write it today. So I sort of do my thing and I go on these shows once in a while. And last week, 2 days ago, I was on the Ed Schultz show. Anybody watch that on MSNBC? He's a good guy, pretty good. I wouldn't want to discuss every issue with him, but he's generally a good guy, and he's good on these working people's issues. But as usual, I'm pegged up against some right-wing person, and the discussion is, basically, is Elena Kagan a lesbian? Now, it could have been any number of other important things, like Sarah Palin said today that Barack Obama wants to eliminate all guns. We wish. So they would discuss the Palin thing for a long time. It could be the Google versus Apple debate. How is Google doing versus the iPhone? How excited are we? But no, yesterday it was about this photograph that the Wall Street Journal put on the cover of her playing softball. Actually, an incredibly flattering, great photograph, right? I mean, you wish that you had a photograph of you like that on the front page of any paper. I said it shows her great commitment to Title IX. And we can only hope that she wields that bat as strong about constitutional rights and in defense of constitutional rights. But I had to deal with the fact that this is a stupid discussion to be having. Stupid, right? I mean, I said in a comment, and I really don't care. I think we could do with a whole lot more lesbians on the Supreme Court and everywhere else, yes. But I really don't care who she sleeps with as long as it's not Larry Summers, the guy who appointed her at Harvard, just in case you were wondering. He was a big favorite. I mean, she was a big favorite of his. I guess she was one of those women that didn't know how to do math. And anyway, that's the only thing I really care about when it comes to her personal habits, is how close is she to Larry Summers and the folks at Goldman Sachs and you name it. But here we are engaged in this discussion about this stupid photograph. And is this photograph Rupert Murdoch's effort to make sort of lewd suggestions about her sexuality? And in discussing it, we will discuss her sexuality. And I thought about it afterwards, and I thought, now I know what that $5 billion was spent on. Do you remember Rupert Murdoch spent $5 billion, 60% above share price, to buy the Wall Street Journal? Right? This was to buy the narrative. This was to buy the storytelling capacity to explain what's happening in our country. The Wall Street Journal only has to run that story once for money. The rest of the time, it is run for free, for at least 48 hours. Kind of like that Goldwater bomb commercial, you know, campaign ad. They only had to pay for it once. And then it played and played and played and played. And I think we are being played and played and played and played. What we need, and while I was thinking about MSNBC, I was thinking, you know, the storytelling is so important. because there are two narratives out there about why people are in the pain that they're in. And they are. And first we have to say the economy is not recovering for most people, almost all people. Then we have to explain it, right? And there's two stories out there. And what we're not telling when we're telling the, what is Elena Kagan's sexuality story, is we're not telling our version of what is happening. And there are two on offer. One is the right wing's explanation for what's happening, which is the immigrants took your jobs, right? And there is, right now, probably as we speak, teachers being fired from their jobs in Arizona because they have an accent. They've not only passed 1070, but they've also killed ethnic studies yesterday. There were 9 students arrested yesterday, I heard on Democracy Now! This morning, in protest. Heaven forbid any of them be undocumented, they'll be immediately deported, whether they have kids here or not. There are initiatives coming up state after state. Oklahoma has an initiative to rescind the birthright rights of people who are born here. The guy who's proposing it says, well, that was only under the 14th Amendment to deal with slaves. And it's not about citizens who are born to non-citizens. The story we're being told by the right is that story, and the story we're being told by MSNBC, who kind of are these days the liberal media, right? There wasn't a liberal media when I was at FAIR, but there kind of is now, liberal in that British social liberal democrat way, but worse than that. The story they're telling is it's all the Tea Party's fault. Right? How much airspace do they spend on MSNBC talking about the Tea Partiers and talking about Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann? There's only so many times I can go on those shows and say, we shouldn't even be talking about this. Eventually, I should just not go, and maybe you would suggest that I didn't go. It's a constant equation. But there's a third story, a complicated story about why our economy is this way, and it didn't happen 2 years ago, it happened over the last 3 decades. Suppressing wages, driving people into debt, then having a stock market based on gambling on that debt. There's a complicated series of things having to do with stripping away social safety nets and stripping away the expectations of people and the security of people to do any of the kind of organizing and activism that they were doing in Jackson State days and Kent State days. You've got the governor today said that the California's economy was in the Eurozone, was like the Eurozone. I thought, oh, great, he's going to compare California to Greece? That means maybe Californians will act like Greeks. National strike tomorrow. I'm going to end, but I think that's where we're at. That there is a narrative that's missing. And you people could tell it. You, at grassroots radio level, could tell that story. When people come back to me and they say, well, there isn't the kind of anti-war activism today that there was in the 60s because we don't have a draft. It's like, who are you kidding? Did you hear the thing about 4 out of 10 African-American young men unemployed? 1 out of 5 Americans underemployed or unemployed? Don't tell me we don't have a draft. Make that connection. I'll leave it at that, but really, it's not congressional hearings we need in Tomasi or BP, or any of that stuff, or Goldman Sachs. It's not congressional hearings we need. We need court hearings. We need some of these people taken away in chains. And I had a suggestion for the derivatives traders that were being finger-wagged by the Congress the other day. Everyone said, well, what can you do? I said, well, why don't you do exactly what we did, what Oklahoma wants to do with women who want abortions? Did you hear the new law? Vetoed twice, but finally overcame the governor's veto. You now, if you want an abortion in Oklahoma, it's not funny, but you can be strapped to a gurney and required to listen to the heartbeat of your fetus, as if this had never occurred to you before, that there was a heartbeat there. And told all the negative implications of your choice. And I thought, well, that's that's interesting. What if we strapped some derivative traders into those stirrups, made them put on that gown, and listen to the, you know, high-pitched squeals of people who can't pay their mortgages? You know, what if we strap the folks who are in charge of British Petroleum and Halliburton and the Interior Secretary and force them to listen to the pleas of people who've just lost their entire livelihood on the Gulf Coast, not to mention the mammals who are, even as we speak, turning up dead? I think we have some solutions we could suggest. People always say the left doesn't propose solutions. I've got a good one. But we need to raise our voices, and I thank you all for the work that you do. Thanks.